High School Slumber Party is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things Cage Club related, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
School is out and it's Friday night. I'm all wrapped up and I feel alright.
Welcome, rich girls, football stars, roughnecks, and waitresses. Oh, and an extra special shout-out to you movie theater attendants out there. This is High School Slumber Party, the podcast where me and some friends look back at our teenage years through the lens of some iconic high school-centric films. I'm Brian Rodriguez, and the party's at my house this evening. But first, school is still in session. And boy, do we have an iconic movie we're talking about today. Hope you did your homework, because the film we're discussing is a big one, it's a very important one, it's a very, very good one. The Last Picture Show. But before we get into The Last Picture Show, did you guys enjoy the Halloween special? Pretty spooky, right? Okay, maybe not that spooky, I don't know. I had fun. I think the ghost has finally rid itself from the high school slumber party classroom and my apartment, but who knows? Let's just, you know, hope he doesn't reappear and nobody bring any Ouija boards to the slumber party. We'll leave it at that. Have you guys been up to anything cool? Have you got John Cusack to unblock me? No? I figured. Oh, man. So, as I mentioned, today's film, very different than last week. It's not a Teen Witch. Thank you, Shawnee, again. It's not a Teen Witch. This film, it's a serious one, an Oscar-winning one, and I hadn't seen it before, so I was super stoked to bring on the Godfather, Joey Lewandowski, and he suggested, I mean, he was really excited to do this film, he suggested bringing on another host from the Cage Club Podcast Network, the host of The Contenders, well, the co-host of The Contenders, Tobin Addington, because I guess Tobin was the guy who really shined light on this film for Joey, and we have an awesome conversation. I'm so excited to dive into that. Whoa, whoa, whoa! Did you forget the classroom setup here? The bell doesn't dismiss you. I dismiss you. I wanted to tell you about my trip to Texas. So this film takes place in Texas, and ironically, I was just in Texas for a bachelor party for my friend Dan. Oh, you know Dan. He was on our Halloween episode. And coincidentally, he's on our episode next week, but we'll tell you about that later. But Dan's bachelor party and former co-host of PS I Love Hoffman with me, Kyle Reinfried, he was the host of it, I suppose. He's the best man, so we went to Dallas and we went to Austin. And I bring it up not just to brag about my exotic travels, but for a couple reasons. First, Texas is awesome, ate good food, drank a good beer, I guess. My biggest regret there is I didn't get to check out any roller derby, like shout out to Queen Elizabeth II suggested, because I know Austin has the best roller derby, but that's because it was out of season. Still, I want to shout out the Texas Roller Derby, TXRD, or the TXRD Holy Rollers, as I follow on my Instagram now. I saw a poster for them in a bar. I'm like, damn it, next time I'm in Austin, I gotta do some roller derby. And you guys know that I'm a big fan of roller derby now from our episode on Whip It, so you definitely want to check that out. The other reason I mentioned Texas, as I said, this movie takes place in Texas, The Last Picture Show. And it was so weird because, well, you know, we know Texas and football, they go hand in hand, especially high school football. And as we were driving from Dallas to Austin, we had to stop to switch drivers, so we stopped in this little town. I don't know, you know, there's an awesome donut shop there. I wish I could remember the name because I would shout it out. But I was looking a little down the road and I saw this huge stadium. And I was wondering to myself, what college is in this little town? Because the stadium is huge. Then I realized, oh my god, this is a high school football stadium. Bigger than any high school football stadium I'd ever seen. But I guess that's Texas, right? God Country Football or something like that. God bless Texas. Anyway, without further ado, let's get into this movie because really, this is going to be one of the best films we talk about on this podcast. I guarantee that. If you haven't seen it, definitely pause this podcast and see it, or watch it after, whatever, but trust me. But let's get into it. I leave you with Hank Williams, Why Don't You Love Me Like You Used To. Class dismissed. My hair's still curly and my eyes are still blue. Why don't you love me like you used to do? Ain't had no loving like a hugging and a kissing and a long, long while. We don't get nearer, further, closer than a country mile. Why don't you spark me like you used to do? And say sweet nothings like you used to coo. I'm the same old trouble that you've always been through. So why don't you love me like you used to do? I don't know what's taken me so long to see this film.
Well, so the reason that I want to do this movie for this podcast, and the reason that I was like, hey, Tobin's going to want to talk about this movie too, is because in college, before I graduated, Tobin, the other guest, who I am spoiling by not letting you introduce him, gave me a list of the 25 movies he thought people should see. Like, how many people did you give this out to, would you say, Tobin?
Oh, man, not many. I would only give it to people who asked for it. I didn't want to like thrust it upon people, you know.
Wow.
So I have this list of 25 movies and this was on there, and I remember I went through, I still haven't seen all of them. I feel like I'm at where I was at 5 years ago. I've seen like almost 20 of them. But this was on the list. Another one, at least one other one that you're going to be doing for this podcast at some point, Brian, Election is also on the list.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yes.
But there's a... Toby, do you remember... I mean, I don't know if this is fun for anybody but me, but do you remember other movies on that list of 25?
Man, I'm going to guess that Seven Samurai was on there.
Yes, ding, ding, ding. Oh, if we had a contender's ding, I would ding it right here. Ding.
Yes. Oh, do you have the list there?
Are you? I do, I'm looking at it.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to... Is The General on there?
No.
The Mr. Keaton movie? No. Yeah, I'm not sure. What else is on there?
Atonement, you just did Laggies for your podcast, so Atonement, another Keira Knightley. Badlands, Bob Roberts, Bottle Rocket, Brick, another high school movie, Brick, Bring a Baby, Casino, Charade, Chinatown, The Conversation, Election, Grizzly Man, History of Violence, Last Picture Show, Ordinary People, Paths of Glory, A Perfect World, The Searchers, Seven Samurai, Shadow of a Doubt, Spanish Prisoner, Spartan, The Third Man, and 3 Days of the Condor, and also the TV series Rome.
Mm. Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah, that's a very American-heavy list. I would make a different list these days.
Wow, that's cool. I feel a podcast coming on, Tobin's 25 with you two.
Ooh.
See them. Ooh. Revisit
a limited
them.
Run. I like that.
See what you'd add. Yeah, no. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Also, well, like because, how the list was appetized. I appreciate it.
I mean, because
that.
We just, Tobin and I were just, we did record, what did we record? Oh, a terrible Charlize Theron podcast. Dark Places.
Good podcast.
Good podcast. Short podcast. Terrible movie. Before that, this is a exclusive. For the high school slumber party crowd, but you know, we do Cinemakers, and Tobin was on our Soderbergh run. And the goal of Cinemakers for me and Mike was to do newer directors. I don't know why we put this list on, but why we put this rule in. But we're like, hey, only people who basically started around 1990 and to today. But I was like, you know, I really want to do Kubrick, but I want to do it with Tobin so that Tobin can teach me Kubrick while we do these movies. So I like this idea of Tobin's 25, so you can teach these, you know, 25 movies that are pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
Well, there's a Kubrick on that list. Paths of Glory is a Kubrick movie. Yeah.
I'm very excited for this Tobin lesson because everyone else has gotten these Tobin lessons on this podcast, and I haven't. I didn't go to film school. I'm the least filmed person, I suppose, on this podcast. So I'm super stoked because Joey, when I released this list to you, one of the first, my list, Brian's list of high school films. Yes. I don't want to get people's lists confused.
Brian's 400, Tobin's 25 and Brian's 400.
Essentially. Like I said, I'm going to be doing this till I have my own high schoolers. But this film was one of those that you right away said that you wanted to do Joey and you're like, you have to have Tobin on this one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to see this film until we do it. And obviously it's in like early part of the history of this show. So I wanted to see it because you said good things. And I'm going to, spoiler alert for the end, guys. I really, really thought this film was awesome. So
I mean,
can't wait to talk about it.
I told you before we started recording that, or, when we were talking this afternoon, that I like my tradition of only being on the best movies that this podcast has to offer. I mean, like, Breakfast Club is pretty good, but I still think of all the movies you've done, this and Edge of 17 are probably the two best ones, so keeping that streak alive.
We're going to ruin your streak one day. I should have had you on the kissing booth.
No!
Oh, man.
I'm going to find one that I'm going to beg you to do that's going to be just the worst. But no, so far, you're right. So far, so good. You've been hitting some good ones. And Joey, since you were on Edge of 17 and you have been on this episode, why don't you do the honors of introducing yourself so you can show our new guest, Tobin, the ropes?
Sure, of course. Joey Lewandowski, 100 and Central Regional High School, class of 2006. Go Red Devils.
The Red Devils, yeah. And since last time you said you had an epically unremarkable high school experience, any stories to share today, Joey, or are we just keeping it at?
So my parents are in the process of cleaning out the house so that they can sell the house and move to South Carolina, now that they're both retired, and they gave me a box of papers of school stuff, and, I do remember the name. Okay, I'm proud of myself. I took a class, I think my junior year or sophomore year of high school, called The Art and Craft of Film. And that is a particular note tonight only because in like a 45-day, every day for 2 hours or 90-minute class, we watched probably 9 or 10 movies. And one of those movies of note tonight, not this movie, but Red River, which they watch in this movie. So there was a lot of movies that I still, probably should rewatch, but like that and Breaking Away and The Endless Summer and like these like really good movies like I don't know if I've seen since that I feel like at 16 years old I was like I can't appreciate these but like there's stuff out there that I should be paying attention to.
That's still pretty impressive for high school.
I think so.
Some of the movies you're mentioning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously. Yeah.
I'm jealous of that class too. Wow.
And I do remember that the teacher was very, he wasn't really bragging about himself, but there was a guy who went to our high school, I think that he had taught, that went on to win an Academy Award for a short film, an animated short film, for this movie called More, which I don't know if either of you guys seen. I think I talked about it with somebody recently, but it's like this claymation little short where it is a guy who works at a factory, a really dead-end factory, and then I think he uses, I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's an Academy Award winning film, so I will I'll find it, I'll send it to you guys right now.
Awesome. Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
So one day we'll get our Oscar together, but for now this guy, whatever his name, who did More,
Mark Osborne,
shout out.
And
if you watch the
video, if you just search Mark Osborne's More on Google or YouTube, the first thing that comes up is Flemington Pictures, which is where my high school was. So of particular note.
I'm glad you brought a story this time, because last time you just brushed over the high schoolness. We're peeling the onion, Joey. We're peeling the onion. Eventually, by the end of this podcast, 4 years from now, I'm going to get you to cry about something that happened in high school.
Oh, okay.
That's my goal.
Well, those are the kind of stories you're looking for? Jeez.
I'm from Joey, maybe. Not from everybody.
Okay. Cool. <That'll> be...
Okay, Tobin, are you familiar with how to introduce yourselves, or would you like a tutorial?
I think so. I can take a shot, and you can tell me if I go wrong.
Go for it.
I guess I'm going to ask a question first. We start with a name, yeah? I got name, high school, year, and mascot.
Yes.
Is that where we're headed? All right, I can do that. I am Tobin Addington. I went to Hellgate High School, class of 1997. Go Knights.
Hellgate?
Yeah, did you say Hellgate?
Said Hellgate.
Wow. Yes.
And then they decided to make the team the Knights?
Yeah, they did.
It needs to be like the demons or something like
I think probably Hellgate Devils felt a little on the nose.
I mean, plus I'm the Red Devil, so I already have that covered on this podcast, so we're all good.
Good. Yes, I was a knight.
I don't know. Just doesn't seem. That's not on the nose enough. I mean, high school mascots are supposed to be on the nose. In my high school conference, not my high school, we used to play against Fairlawn High School, and they were the Cutters. Fairlawn Cutters.
Oh, okay.
Not like self-harm, but like...
I assume...
Like landscaping.
Yeah, I assume. I don't know. Because you don't have lawn in your name and then say the Cutters and say that you're named after a ship or something, you know? That's a landlocked town.
Seriously.
You know, I was flying back... This is a little bit of a humble brag, but I was there for a wedding. I wasn't just there for fun. But I was flying back from Scotland yesterday, and on the plane, there were 100 movies you could pick from, so I was half watching those while I watched stuff that I hadn't seen before on my iPad. So I watched, of course, Fast 5 and Furious 7 and Fate of the Furious, because too fast, too forever, hashtag family. But then I watched most of Happy Death Day, which is a recent horror movie that I love, and that if it wasn't a college movie, it was a high school movie, I would have already forced you into doing it for this podcast, Brian. But what I found out in that movie, talking about mascots, is that their college mascot, I think, is the baby, or a baby, which I never noticed. I've seen this movie three or four times now. I never noticed that before, and I was like, oh, this is the coolest, weirdest thing. So it's just like the face is like this baby face, and I think it's just like the babies. I don't know what they are, but greatest mascot in movie history.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So, Tobin, any high school stories? What were you like in high school? Tell the high school slumber party audience what your high school experience was like.
I had a great time in high school. I came from a K through 8th grade school where my graduating class was about 50 students.
Wow.
And then went to a high school where there were 2,500 kids in the school. So it was a, you know, you go from being, you know, labeled whatever you were in like third grade all the way through junior high to then having to sort of reinvent yourself. So I had a really good time. I was the drum major by the end of school, the marching band. Yep. And we had instead of a baton, I had a sword because we were the knights.
Oh, that's really cool.
So I would march with this big sword, and I was in drama. And so here's one story. So second half of high school, I started making movies, little short movies with like video cameras from the local cable access TV station. And I made one that took place at a high school, these two high school kids who sort of like run into each other as school's over, and it's like 7 minutes long, and at the end of it, they kiss, and that's the end of the movie. So I got some friends together, and I talked this teacher into staying at school on a weekend so I could shoot this thing on a Saturday. And we shot the little movie, and they had their little scenes together, and they had their little kiss. And I found out not until later that it was a boy and a girl. I can't remember which one. I think it was the boy. It was his first kiss ever.
Whoa. Wow, you created some magic there.
It turns out I did. So anyway, that was me in high school, getting people to kiss on camera for the first time.
Nice. That's awesome. So sounds like, again, fun high school experience. A little different than the high school experience in this film, I assume. The Last Picture Show. Not quite that kind of town.
Although, what I will say, and this is what I just messaged you on Facebook, there was some sexual drama in this movie behind the scenes as well, which, again, IMDb trivia, don't know if this is real or not, but Tobin, did you know, according to the IMDb trivia, that Cybill Shepherd had an affair with Jeff Bridges while making this movie, and had an affair with Peter Bogdanovich, to such extent that, like, he got a divorce from his wife with kids to be with Cybill Shepherd for a while, at least.
Oh, yes, and I can add to that his wife co-wrote his first movie with him and was the production designer on it, and was the production designer on this movie.
Oh,
and
no.
Stayed on this movie even during the affair and divorce. Like, it wasn't like an affair like, hey, I'm secretly sleeping with Cybill Shepherd. It's like, I've cast Cybill Shepherd in this movie. I've fallen in love with her. We can't be together anymore. I'm going to be with Cybill Shepherd.
Oh, wow.
And they keep making... They keep making the movies together, and she goes on to production design his next two movies as well.
What?
Yeah. And then the story goes that once she stopped working on his movies, because two of his first four movies are downright classics. And then once she was out of the picture, he never made a movie like that again. So yeah, there was a lot, lots of shenanigans going on.
And this was Sybil Shepherd's first movie, so to basically enter with such a literal and metaphorical bang, if you will, is impressive? Question mark.
Well, she was a teenager. I mean, he found her from, she was a cover model, a cover girl on like magazines, and he saw on this magazine and it's like you can be JC, and she was, and you know, it sort of detonated a marriage. Yeah.
Wow, so weird. That's so interesting, though, because I was looking at his career, and I'm like, huh, real drop-off here.
Yeah, yeah.
Potential explanation there. Wow, good fact. I like these facts.
Yeah. And most people know him as he's Dr. Melfi's psychiatrist on The Sopranos.
Oh,
he's the
my God, okay. Yes.
Yep.
That's Peter Bogdanovich.
Wow. You know, yeah. I saw, like, I knew he was a director. Then I remember, like, I was watching Sopranos maybe, like, 6 months ago, like, rewatching it. And I remember seeing his name, and I'm like, that can't be the same guy, because why the hell would it be? Like, I didn't know what he looked like and everything. Wow, that makes so much, well, it doesn't make any sense, but
yeah,
I'm glad that was made clear. That's interesting little fact. I feel like The Sopranos come up a lot on this podcast, and you wouldn't think for a high school podcast, but whatever. By the way, it seems like everyone likes this movie, and I'm the only idiot who hasn't seen it, I guess, because it's 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And I do this every week, and I don't want to forget about it because I really want to dive in and read the back of the VHS cover. So here goes, guys. Now, this wasn't released on VHS till much, much later. I think like the late 80s or early 90s. So
yeah, there wasn't VHS when this movie came out in 1971.
I didn't know what else to read. I haven't done too many very old high school films, so the gimmick doesn't work as well for the old ones. Anyway, released in 1971 to critical acclaim and public controversy, The Last Picture Show garnered 8 Academy Award nominations and was hailed as the most important work by a young director since Citizen Kane. A surprisingly frank, bittersweet drama of social and sexual mores in a small town, Texas, this film features a talented cast led by Jeff Bridges, Sybil Shepherd, Timothy Bottoms, Cloris Leachman, and Ben Johnson, and in parentheses, who won Academy Awards in supporting roles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it, so.
Yeah, it's accurate.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no, like, controversial or cute line in there, but pretty much sums it up. By the way, this cast is so amazing. Like, just to see these people so young.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Jeff Bridges, obviously Sybil Shepherd, but the one who I really was like, oh my God, was Randy Quaid.
Yes, yes.
Is that guy Lester? That was pretty awesome. So I wasn't too familiar with Ben Johnson, but, you know, apparently, you know, he's famous for like cowboy films or something.
Yeah, for Westerns. In fact, he didn't want to do this movie because it was worried there were too many words in it.
That's crazy.
And so Bogdanovich, who before making movies was a critic and spent a lot of time hanging out with Orson Welles and John Wayne and John Ford, he got John Ford to call Ben Johnson and tell him he needed to be in this movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wasn't he 31 when he directed this? He was like friends with John Ford at 30, 31? Wow.
Yeah, he was super precocious, like talked his way into inner circles, and he's a kind of a fascinating guy. He's a little bit kind of, oh, I don't know, there's a little bit of a conceitedness to the sound of his voice sometimes. Like, you know, it's like all sort of inside baseball stuff, but yeah, he had access to these people in kind of an amazing way.
Wow, that's really cool.
When I was looking through the IMDb trivia, there was another thing where he like referenced or like asked Orson Welles about like how he should make this movie. He's like, of course you should do it in black and white. I was like, who has access to Orson Welles? Like, he's like, oh, I have a question about my movie. Who should I ask? How about Orson Welles?
Yeah, makes me feel really unaccomplished for someone the same age as him when he did this film.
You know.
But yeah, I mean, Ben Johnson is like awesome in this. He ends up, as I said, winning the Academy Award, and I think he was in it for like 9 minutes or something, I read, which is crazy. But I have to talk about Cloris Leachman, because I am a huge Mary Tyler Moore fan. I'm a fan of like the old sitcoms. That's like my thing. And I can't believe this version of Cloris Leachman. this like Academy Award awesome version of Cloris Leachman that I'm just like mind blown. This is like a very mind blowing film to me.
Yeah, it feels out of place from the sort of a lot of the, because she has all various personas in her career. You know, that depending on sort of big blocks, what you know her from. I feel like everybody knows Cloris Leachman, but they sort of know a different version of her. And this is my favorite. I mean, I've always enjoyed her, but she does more. She goes through more emotions in a close-up than almost anybody else I know. It's remarkable to watch in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, she just brought it. Like, I'm just gushing over this film, so I apologize, but just want to get my facts out of the way, though. This, of course, is based on a novel by Larry McMurtry, if I got that right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so first, you mentioned the black and white thing. What do you guys just think of the overall feel of this film, just from the sound and the look and that sort of thing? Because it's definitely distinct in that respect.
I mean, I feel like, sort of as background for our relationship, I guess, Tobin was on the run of Cinemakers that Mike and I did of Steven Soderbergh. And one of the things that we kept running into on trivia early on in Soderbergh's career was that he wanted to make every movie in black and white. And the studios were like, no, you got to stop that. You got to do color movies. And I feel like this is the kind of movie that, you know, set in 51 but filmed in 70 or 71 that Soderbergh could look at and be like, why can't I just make this movie? And because there is like something like just beautiful and like retro and nostalgic and just a real throwback to just the way that it's shot and the way that it looks and being in that little dead end nothing town where there's like nothing around, but it just seems, you know, I just love the way it looks.
One of the reasons they were able to shoot this movie in black and white is that, first of all, it was basically independently financed. Second of all, it was cheaper, they thought, or they could make an argument that it would be more expensive to repaint the town, because this is the actual town, even though they didn't have to do much to it to make it look run down, because it was as run down in 1970 as it was in 1951. But it needed the colors would have needed to change. Like, there was these green walls, it looked more modern in its color scheme. So part of it was just a sort of, oh, this would be easier if we just shoot it in black and white. But I think it adds to the desolation of this movie. This movie is remarkable to me in the way that it balances humor and tragedy, often simultaneously, not even like one after another, and setting it in this you know, desolate place. Credit to Bogdanovich's wife, at least his wife at the start of the movie, for the production design of this movie, because it just, not a frame of this movie does not feel to me sort of kind of desolate and in some kind of pain.
Oh yeah, oh my god. And it's just the words that kept coming to my mind when I was watching this film were just like realness, you know? And I'm sure that wasn't a word at the time. It felt like a film from the 50s, but with a realness, a modern realness that you would never see in a film from that era. Mm. Which, I don't know, it was like so freaking chilling. And just, the setting, like, I feel like I was in this town, essentially.
What I like about this movie in terms of that, Brian, is like when you, or at least I don't know, maybe just the movies that I'm watching or whatever, like when you watch like these old-timey movies that, like, especially the big ones, it feels like everyone was so like refined and so well to do back then, and like there were no societal problems. And like seeing a movie like this where people are sleeping around and, you know, cheating on their husbands who might be also cheating on them with their quarterback, or like, you know, having abortions and like this like really gritty raw realness, it feels like this is the movie that like people in the 50s maybe wanted to make but were afraid or unable to make due to whatever reason. And I like seeing this like sort of seedy underbelly that shows like, oh, we've always been kind of messed up as a people in society.
Yeah, no, like it's true, as like screwed up as that is, that's exactly what I thought. It's like surprisingly a little comforting that like people in the 50s, and again, I know it was shot in the 70s and stuff, but had the same like screwed up problems as we have today. Because Joe, you hit the nail on the head. Everything I've seen from like that era is very, and great films, but very sterilized when it comes to like moral stuff. And this was, yep, like, it's like a throwback, but like modern and real. I don't know. Again, I'm in love.
Brian, I love what you said about the realness of it. the scene that I remember the first time I saw this movie that made me, I sort of sat up and was like, oh, this is different from what I'm used to. I think it's the scene where Sonny and his girlfriend go parking early on in the movie, and she takes off her top, and it's this sort of awkward, they've been at the movies, right? And then they go park, yeah. And it's this awkward, funny and sad and
really unsexy.
Yes. Really unsexy sex that felt very authentic, right? Like it feels like, you know, this feels like how high school kids have been fumbling around in cars as long as there have been cars in high school kids, including today. Like it feels, and so you're seeing a film made with a lot of the sort of stylistic impulses of movies from the 50s, like you're saying, but then the content that you're seeing, the especially how graphic the emotional stuff and the sex stuff is, then feels very, or at least the nudity, that then feels very sort of shocking, these two things juxtaposed next to one another.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing that you bring up, with just the whole, I took this note, and it's like the subtlety of how awkward they are when they take like bras off. It's just perfect, you know, like that's, mm-hmm. especially like you said, for high schoolers, it just looks awkward and weird and like unsexy, as you said. It's just, I love films like this.
since you hadn't seen it before, Brian, I'm curious what you thought it was going to be like, did any cultural osmosis tell you anything about this movie, or did you come in as a blank slate?
This was a complete blank slate to me. Huh. The only thing I knew about it is it's on a lot of people's lists to see.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
The Tobin 25.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like the Tobin 25. But I had no idea it was even a high school film till I started putting together a list of, and I just looked it up on top high school films. But I had no idea. And it's nice. I'm very, very happy about that because I'll never get to see Star Wars like for the first time. I'll never get to see movies that I wish I could see as an adult for the first time. And it's always fun when you discover a great old film for the first time and you're able to process it and like remember the first time you saw this film, which is obviously what, like 2 days ago for me. So maybe that's why I'm so excited, because I mean, it almost, I'm going to say the only hype I was getting about this film was from Joey too. So
right.
Like true hype somebody I know.
So it felt like a discovery a little bit then.
Yeah, absolutely. Like some of my best friends, some of the guys I talk about film with, most of them have also not seen this film. So I can't wait to be like, yo, you got to watch this movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. Like that's, you know, it's really, really, really good.
And it's such a, I don't want to say breath of fresh air because that's too mean. Because I do like what I do and I do like these high school films.
I hope so. This was your idea.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. I haven't been forced at gunpoint to do this show. But it's so nice to see a good, well-made movie that's not just a good high school movie, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting because this movie is, as much as it is a quote-unquote high school movie, and it's very much about the lives of these high schoolers, it's also about the lives of kind of this town and maybe America, both in the early 50s and the early 70s. Like it seems to resonate about a lot of different things, and yet, you know, still be technically a high school movie. Do we ever see them in school? We see them...
Yeah, there's a scene with like their teacher and he's trying to get through to them and they're kind of like just don't care.
That's right. Their teacher who goes on to be in Magnum P.I. I don't know. That's
really?
TV show from my era. But yes, yes. Okay, right. That's right. Then there's the funny thing with the comb and the... Yeah, okay. Right, right. Yeah, so but there's not a lot of emphasis on it. We don't spend a lot of time in the school.
No. What I feel like is relatable to high school is that it's sort of like a series that I've been thinking a lot about lately because we're recording this and it's sort of, you know, college football season and I've been thinking, and high school football season, and I've been thinking a lot of Friday Night Lights lately, and it just seems like this whole town, in a way, I mean, this dying town, revolves sort of around the high school football team, or at least, like, that's, like, a central part of the conversation, you know, criticizing or commenting on or whatever the game or the players, or like, you know, girls only hooking up with guys because they were in the backfield or whatever, like, not a euphemism, like, it just seems like the high school experience and who these people are in high school is so fundamental to this town that even if we don't see them in high school for more than a scene, the fact that they are all in high school and who they are is, you know, vital to this movie.
Yeah, it's that Texas high school football stereotype, mm-hmm. but it's also magnified because, let's be honest, this is, like, on the surface, might seem to people as a pretty dull town. And it seems like everything revolves around these high school sports and these high school kids. Mm-hmm. And if you play a high school sport, you're pretty much a celebrity in this little town, which I think is true of a lot of little towns in America. So while it's like it's about the town, you can't tell a story of this town without making the high schoolers and like what they do a huge part of it.
Yeah, and so many of the relationships, so many of the movie seems to be telling us that a lot of the adults in this movie who are at various sort of points of being stuck in their own lives, that being stuck all stems from decisions that they made, actions they took as high schoolers. It was their high school years that sort of set the course for them to end up in the various, you know, stages of dead-endness that we find them in this movie. And the movie seems to be saying that the current high schoolers have a chance to change that, right? Like, it's their chance now.
Yeah.
And yet they're making a lot of the same mistakes that the, you know, that the adults made.
Oh, so depressing. No, but yeah, it's like awesome. And I'm just, certain movies that I'll probably do, some people will argue are not high school films. I will argue to the death to this film because a high school film, because it's definitely it revolves around that.
Yeah, for sure. And even the sort of the structure of the movie is they sort of structure it in the course of this last year of high school for Sonny. I say we're not in school a lot with them, but it's kind of pegged to that, to them growing up, graduating, and heading off to the sort of various sobering things that they end up heading off to in real life. And that feels very you know, tethered to people, since so many of these people aren't going to college. This is the end of their schooling, and so they're like, this is the end of them of May meaning anything, you know, of like graduation. Like, then they're going to be in the quote unquote real world where there is no summer vacation anymore, you know, like that all kind of changes as at the end of this movie.
Yeah, no, once again depressing, but
but it's funny too. It's a very funny, I think it's a very funny movie too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but the most realistic things, I mean, at least my opinion, the most realistic things are, like, jarring and funny.
Right.
You have to have those two elements to make it real.
Bogdanovich has talked about if you watch this movie with less than 25 people, nobody laughs. If you watch this movie with more than 25 people, they laugh at almost every moment in the movie. Both sort of sat, you know, like hard moments and truly slapsticky moments or you know, verbal jokes or whatever. Like he talks about you talk about Randy Quaid. There's he's basically his introduction in this movie. He just walks on screen. And he says, if you watch this movie in a big crowd, people laugh just at how gangly and goofy he looks when he walks on screen. And I had the opportunity to, after Joey had graduated from the college that I, that where we met, I taught a class in 70s American films, and this was, I think, maybe the fourth or fifth movie that I showed to that class. And we watched it in a big auditorium, and there were more than 25 people in the room, and I was a little nervous going into it because I had not tried to show it to, you know, to young people, and I was just a little unsure. And by the third scene, they're laughing with it, and you know, that it's one of the ones that everybody came away from that class really, really loving.
Awesome. Ugh. See, I missed out on my, whether it be high school or college education, but luckily through this podcast and through the help of you guys, I'm getting to right a wrong from my past.
Well, there you go.
So I thank you for that. You mentioned the graduation earlier. One of my favorite little, I don't know, it's not really a scene, but like when they have their graduation and they're singing that Texas, I guess it's like a Texas state anthem. It just reminds me of like, it feels like in this movie, and correct me if I'm wrong, most of the music is like internal, like whether they play it on the jukebox or it's just playing on the radio, right. Or they're singing it.
Mm-hmm.
There's like no score, right?
There's no score in the movie. Yep.
Yeah,
that's right.
I thought that was interesting and also pretty, pretty cool.
Yeah, the music too changes depending on whenever Cybill Shepherd is in the scene, the music is no longer country. Like, there's country music and honky tonk music, there's Hank Williams music, and there's one song, I can't remember the name of it, but it plays in an early scene, and I think it's a Hank Williams version of it, and then a Tony Bennett version plays when we're in JC's room and she's listening to the radio to like separate her from the sort of like, you know, set from this town, just in this kind of very subtle way. There's nothing in this movie that isn't thought through. And that's one of the things I think I appreciate as a filmmaker, as well as just someone who likes movies and likes high school movies, is that that there's not an inch of this movie that wasn't deliberate on the parts of the people who are making it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's super cool. And kind of equal to that is like, just the Texasness of this film and just how accurate it is to, like, I know it's not a real town, but in terms of just like the geography of the area, you feel like you know it. Even down to the fact that they drink Dr. Pepper, you know, it's just very, very like Texan, and it just keeps you there. And you feel, again, you feel like you're in this town. And like you said, every inch of this movie is like well thought out and awesome. And hey, if that has to do with his wife, as much as it has to do with him, then power to everyone. Power to his wife, power to his girlfriend, because they really, really made something special. So I kind of just want to touch on a little bit of these plot points. So the first one really is the whole, well, I guess this kind of revolves around a bunch of love triangles, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
There's the coach's wife, Ruth, and Sonny. Well, first Sonny has that girlfriend, then he gets in with Ruth. What do you guys think of that relationship, like the younger guy with the somewhat older woman and that whole thing?
I mean, I'm sure it happened all the time in towns like this, and, you know, like we were saying earlier, it just isn't usually depicted in movies like this. I also, you know, again, thinking about Friday Night Lights, just thinking about if a player ever, you know, like Mrs. Coach was like the epitome of like the perfect wife and mother and woman and role model. And but like you can also see like in a dark version of Friday Night Lights, like this movie essentially, where she could fall prey to just these young people all around. But, you know, I'm sure it happened all the time when there's just infidelity on the other half and, you know, boredom and opportunity and whatever.
Well, and also we can't forget she's facing some kind of rather dire medical diagnosis. Like the reason Sonny is in her life is to drive her to a doctor. And it's we're never told, as I remember it, we're never told what it is or what's going on, but it doesn't seem good. And the coach is never there with her. Like it's you know, he's pawned this job off on Sonny. And what's remarkable to me about their relationship is that it does not feel to me predatory in the way I can't imagine writing this this movie, because I don't know how, and maybe today you couldn't do it. Maybe it would have to be set in the past, or maybe it's the performances. I don't know. Maybe you guys can tell me. But to me, it doesn't feel predatory on her part, and it doesn't feel on his part like he's taking advantage of her. It really does feel to me as though these two people have found each other in this moment, and maybe they're not into it for the same things. But who is in any relationship, right? I mean, that's especially in high school. That's part of what you're figuring out. And so I've always been fascinated by this relationship.
What I like about it is how much is unsaid. Like the fact that her husband might be having an affair with the quarterback is never said in the movie. Like that's just something that she said after they made the movie. So like you don't really know why their marriage is falling apart or why he's not around. You don't know what's wrong with her. It's just like you said, you know, two people found each other through whatever circumstances, whatever's going on that we don't know about, and it works for them. You know, at least in the moment, if not, you know, the last scene between them, like, it's a tender moment, but, like, you don't know if that's, like, the last time that they're going to see each other or if they're going to go on further than that. Like, whether they go on forever and maybe get married, who knows? But, like, in this moment, in these, like, 10 or 12 or 14 months or whatever this movie spans, like, they're there for each other and it works then.
Yeah, that's 100% true. And to Tobin, to hit on your point, my note was, like, why don't I feel more weird about this? Like why isn't, every time I've seen this in films and or heard about it in real life, it's like, all right, someone's the victim here, someone's creepy, and nobody felt like the victim. And I just thought that was like such interesting filmmaking. I mean, I suppose it's the actors, because they do an awesome job. Specifically, again, I think Cloris Leachman is amazing in this, and perhaps it's her, but yeah, that's the most fascinating aspect to me about this. And then I think it was Joey, you had a good point too about like the boredom of this town. I feel like that's like an understated thing. in a lot of, I guess, film. A lot of, like, motivation is boredom sometimes, you know? And I don't know if that's why this couple's motivated, but it certainly doesn't hurt things, you know? There's not much to do here.
Well, I mean, it's also depressing to think about that, you know, after Sam the Lion dies and he leaves that movie theater to that woman, like, she shuts it down because she has no idea what she's doing. And, like, it seems like, aside from the pool hall, it was the only place in town for people to, like, escape themselves maybe for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And for that to close in this dire time of need is not good. But, you know, we have not mentioned yet that there is a sequel to this movie that I have not seen called Texasville, which is a book that I own and have not read either. But it's set, I think, like 30-something years later, and the town still exists. So it's not like it became a ghost town. Like, it still lives. It just, it's got to be even more depressing to live there after, you know, the picture show closes.
Yeah, I was going to mention that sequel at the end. I was like, oh, there's a sequel to this, and I watched the trailer, and it looks like...
Yeah.
Not, yeah.
Yeah.
Not this.
No. No. Same stars, same writers, same director, same novelist, but no. Nope, time. Polly Platt wasn't there for that one, and I really do think that has something to do with it. She, yeah, Bogdanovich's wife was ex-wife was no longer in the picture, so, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm choosing to think that one does not exist.
Yep, that's how I live.
I mean, between you and me and everybody listening to this podcast, there's a reason that I haven't watched or haven't heard Mike's podcast episode from this month yet, because I don't know that I want to watch The Godfather 3. I'm sure it's not as bad as I'm making it out to be, but, like, when you have something as perfect as the first two or this movie, it's like, why do another? You know what I mean?
I've never seen Godfather 3 either. I'm avoiding that podcast for the same reason.
No.
Sorry, Mike.
No, I'm the guest on that podcast.
Sorry, oh, Brian. No.
And defend The Godfather 3.
Okay, well, it's on my list to watch this week if I can get to it, but
look,
I'm nervous.
Do not have Godfather expectations for The Godfather 3. It will not meet those expectations, but it's one of the better films he's done on that podcast. I can guarantee.
Well, I'm sure that's true, because what he's done on that podcast, aside from Superman 3, has been bad. But Superman 3, as we all know, chef's kiss of the finger is just a beautiful work of art. But also, just a quick aside to two movies you've talked about, isn't Sofia Coppola is like a major role in that, right? And she is also in The Outsiders as Domino, you know, another Francis Ford Coppola joint that she popped up in a couple early Cage Club movies, you know, Nicolas Cage's cousin, yeah, as little Domino with a little buck teeth, and I just think she's so adorable in that movie. So there's a Sofia Coppola thread running throughout the Cage Club podcast. Yes. I'm glad to see that you are maintaining and upholding with your Outsiders episode.
Yeah, no, it's true, but she is terrible in The Godfather 3. No. And that's not... I tried to watch Godfather 3 with, you know, like, forget everything, let me just see this movie, and if I enjoy it. Yeah. And look, there were a lot, like, Andy Garcia's great, Joe Montana's great, there are a lot of great elements, but she is just, and I know whatever, Winona backed out, so she had to be in the film, but she is just god-awful. One of the worst, I hate to say it, but it's true, one of the worst
Domino
performances you'll ever see. Not in that. She's okay in
Domino.
The Outsiders. But and Coppola has a last thing we'll talk about is The Godfather 3, I promise. But Coppola has a great line. Spoiler alert for Godfather 3. Michael's daughter in the film. I'm spoiling it because, guys, if you haven't seen The Godfather 3 now, then, you know, you're never going to see it, probably.
Well, I'm going to watch it this week, I think.
Okay, so I won't spoiler alert it for you. Nah, I'll do it anyway. In the film, Coppola says Michael's children have to pay for his sins.
Okay, I like that idea, sure.
So I'll leave it at that vague. And he said, after making it, his children had to pay, like Coppola's children, Sophia, pay for his sins making that film. Because she was on after she did that.
Oh.
And yeah. So, I mean, it's...
Domino.
And it was and it was very, very rushed. So... End of Godfather 3 discussion. You guys can go listen to Third Time's a Charm and hear me talk about that for like an hour and a half. So back to what film are we doing? Last Action Hero?
Last Action Hero.
that great high school movie, Last
Action. Although I think Last Action Hero, while we're talking about other podcasts, I think, didn't Real Bad cover that?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, they did.
That's another podcast on the network here, so go check that out, too.
Plugging away.
While we're detouring through the middle of this podcast talking about this great movie, like, go check out some other stuff.
Anyway, Last Picture Show. Who are we talking about? Oh, Ruth and Sonny. We can get into it a little later. We get into it now, just how that relationship ends up when he, you know, when he ends up with JC or whatever, and he kind of blows her off for what seems like months, I guess. Or
Yeah.
And then, you know, comes back to her in that final scene, which was
never you such mind, a great Brian. Scene. Never you mind. I'm talking
such
to
a
you.
Great scene.
You never, you're talking to me personally. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Not as good as Cloris Leachman. It's the delivery, but still, yeah, no, such a great scene. Such a, oof.
What am I doing apologizing to you? Why am I always apologizing to you, you little bastard? 3 months I've been apologizing to you without you even being here. I haven't done anything wrong. Why can't I quit apologizing? You're the one who ought to be sorry. I wouldn't still be in my bathrobe if it hadn't been for you. I had my clothes on hours ago. You're the one made me quit caring if I got dressed or not. I guess just because your friend got killed, you want me to forget what you did and make it all right? I'm not sorry for you. You'd have left Billy too, just like you left me. I bet you left him plenty of nights. Whenever JC whistled, I wouldn't treat a dog that way. I guess you thought I was so old and ugly, you didn't owe me any explanation. You didn't need to be careful of me. There wasn't anything I could do about you and her. Why should you be careful of me? You didn't love me. Look at me. Didn't you even look at me?
Shouldn't have come here. I'm around that corner now. You've ruined it. It's lost completely. Sure, needing me won't make it come back.
Mrs. O'Malley, out in the valley, suffered from ulcers, I understand.
Never you mind, honey. Never you mind.
I love that.
Yeah, because so much has been repressed in this movie, especially Ruth, especially the Cloris Leachman character, but for a lot of the characters, like they're fumbling around, they're not quite saying what they're feeling, they're talking obliquely, and she just rips into him and sort of shreds herself in front of him to demonstrate how much he's hurt her, and it's so hard to watch, but it's so good and satisfying in some kind of way. And it's like throwing the dishes against the wall. It sounds very over the top, but it just this movie is full of those kind of jagged moments that happen that you don't quite expect. But then in retrospect, you're like, oh yeah, she's been like not saying what's on her mind her whole life until this moment with this kid. And it just I love that scene so much.
Yeah, and it just she's kind of. She's not, I don't find her as like an odd person in this town. I don't think most people in this town say what they've wanted to say their entire life.
Right, exactly. Right, good point.
Yeah, it reminded me even of, what's his name, Sam the Lion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How he gives that whole monologue about a girl he knew and it ends up being JC's mom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just come out here to get a little scenery. Pretty a day it's been in town. You wouldn't believe how this country's changed. First time I seen it, there wasn't a mesquite tree on it. Or a prickly pear neither. I used to own this land, you know. First time I watered a horse at this tank was more than 40 years ago. I reckon the reason why I always drag you out here is probably I'm just as sentimental as the next fella when it comes to old times. Old times. I brought a young lady swimming out here once. More than 20 years ago. It was after my wife had lost her mind. My boys was dead. Me and this young lady was pretty wild, I guess. And pretty deep. We used to come out here horseback and go swimming without no bathing suits. One day she wanted to swim the horses across this tank. Kind of a crazy thing to do, but we'd done it anyway. She bet me a silver dollar she could beat me across. She did. This old horse I was riding didn't want to take the water. But she was always looking for something to do like that. Something wild. I bet she still got that silver dollar.
Whatever happened to her?
Oh, she growed up. She was just a girl then, really. Here, let me help you then.
And, like, you know, there's stuff he didn't want to, he couldn't say there. There's stuff that her mom couldn't say there. And it's just, like, that's kind of just basically how this town lives. They feel, I mean, you know, big picture, yeah, I'm sure all societies like that too. But in terms of, especially in this town, and Cloris Leachman's, what's her, Ruth. Ruth's, like, character's aggression there and emotions and even how she essentially, you know, comforts at the end, it's just, to me, like, the whole town taking it out on, like, everything that's going on and just going back to the way it was. And Texasville aside, it's probably going to continue being that way. And maybe it doesn't fall off the map. But it's just, that's why, you know, in the 20 years later, it's probably going to be the same. 40 years later, that town's probably going to be the same. Obviously, technology and stuff like that changes, but in terms of people, and as long as the town stays small like that and doesn't become an absorbed suburb of something, that's just how it's going to be for these people, it feels like.
Yeah, there's a timeless quality to the whole thing. Like, it's not, this is not going anywhere. The cycle continues. And all you can hope for is a little bit of comfort, like he gets at the end. Like, they both seem to get at the end there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So another character I wanted to touch on, I guess, the Dwayne JC thing, but then more about JC and obviously the touch of classism. The roughnecks versus the rich kids kind of thing.
Ooh, like an Outsiders kind of vibe.
Yeah, a little bit, you know. I mean, where was the Outsiders? Yeah. Oklahoma, right? So, not too far.
Nope, yeah. Panhandle, baby.
So, yeah, so what'd you guys think of all that angle and stuff?
I just still can't get over the fact that this is Sybil Shepherd's first movie. Like, it's incredible, like, what she does in this movie. Like, in terms of, like, what she has to balance on, she has to juggle, and, you know, what she has to convey, and... You know, on-set drama or off-set drama aside, like, her performance is just great, I think.
Yeah, and Jeff Bridges is... Peter Bogdanovich has talked about Jeff Bridges being one of, if not the best actor he's ever worked
with.
Wow. And this being one of his first big roles. He'd been in things before, but not a role this substantial. And I remember the first time I saw it, I came away thinking, oh wow, he looks so young, but I didn't really think about him much beyond that. And in subsequent viewings, he nails something about the way that for some people, high school is a time where you, like, some people who are cool in high school, you realize maybe don't think they're cool, or maybe they're just trying so hard to be cool. And so this is sort of a window into, you know, his anxieties. He gets to show off those anxieties, but he's always trying to cover them in some way. And I think it's a hard thing to do as an actor. And in retrospect, I think he does it really, really well here.
Yeah. I mean, he's awesome. Just, you know, I don't know what else to say, but, like, I forgot it was Jeff Bridges 5 minutes into this film, you know? Like, that didn't become about that anymore. It kept, like, maybe coming back to me, but it's... I mean, that's super high praise by the director there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because he worked, you know, he went on to, other people won Oscars in his movies, not just in this one, in other movies that he'd done, quite a few of them. So it's not like he's working with slouches, you know? But I've never heard him be much more specific about it, but somehow they were able to, in a very unshowy way, kind of anchor that character and that character's, you know, as I say, anxieties and awkwardness inside trying to act tough and cool and, but then being kind of a weasel, but then feeling kind of bad about it. And then eventually then heading off to Korea at the end, like heading off to war, like to see him grow up. And it, his last line to Sonny as he gets on the bus, right, is like, I'll see you in a year or two unless I get shot. Like with this like grin, you know, it's like this whole movie is full of things where you're like, oh my God, this is terrible. But also it's very funny and very, and in that way, it's part of what makes it feel so true. And he does, there's some magic here in him in this movie.
And that's what kind of feels, that also feels sort of depressing there, is that like the only way to get out of this town is to like go possibly die in war. Cause
yeah,
like,
right.
If he comes back from war, like he's not going to leave this town. Like what is he going to do? I mean, we know that, I mean, he's the star of Texasville, so we know that he survives the war, this character survives, but I don't know if he leaves the town or stays in the town or comes back to it or what, but, like, you know, he's always part of that town's DNA. It's just, like, how do you get out? Like, where do you go?
Well, it's fun, and that's why I love the geography of this film. Like, Dallas is like the moon, you know? You go to Dallas, you never come back. Wichita Falls is like their big city, which is probably no more than a town at that point, you know, or like a bigger town, I suppose. And, you know, and everyone just basically goes to other parts of Texas to become an oil, you know, roughneck or whatever they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's your getting out, and you eventually just come back when you're done with the project, you know, it's just no escaping this world. And I was just thinking like, what a different world Korea is going to be for him.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, just, I mean, look, that's the story of war, right? Just small town, you know, guys going
and
seeing a different part of the world. But it's just like, I know that's not the on-screen story, but it was just like, you know, this town and this drama is just, and compared to what's going to go on there, it's just, like I said, just completely different worlds. It might as well be him, you know, killing people in space, essentially.
Ooh, Texasville 2, space.
well, if it's a third film in the series, then it could be on Third Time's a Charm.
Ooh, very true.
Then it'd be forced to have an episode on this podcast.
Mm.
I mean, on this network. Yeah.
Sure.
So, not sure. I'm not sure how that one's gonna go. But yeah, no, I mean, and
well, and for audiences seeing the movie as it comes out, I mean, we're right in the middle of the war in Vietnam, so the idea of a, you know, small town kid shipping off to, you know, Asia to fight in a war and the sort of tragedy, but also, as you say, like that this is his chance to get out of town and sort of see what's out there and escape who he was and, you know, maybe become something new, maybe become something better. Like that combination of sort of hope and despair is just, I think, would have also like that would have resonated with people at the time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a really good point. I didn't even think about the whole Vietnam connection. Yeah, the other thing about Jeff Bridges, too, I mean, I think you mentioned it, too, like, his, I loved his just, like, there was, like, tension in his face sometimes that was so, like, one scene in particular, like, when JC essentially lies to him and then gets in the car with Randy Quaid, and just how he processes that, like, it's,
yes,
it's just, like, it's just great.
Well, and in that moment, she has let him put his hand up her skirt. Like, she takes his hand and puts it up. Like, she says, I really wish I could stay with you, but my mom says I've got to go to this other party with this kid. And then, like, she, you know, puts his hand up her skirt. And so he's, like, dealing with that as well. You know, like, that's part of his, like, oh, my God, what's happening to me here? And now she's gone. And, like, what's going on? It's a great, you know, it's he's, that's what I mean about him, the sort of subtleness of what he's doing is that it's you know, it's in him processing that and sort of trying to figure it out that you really see like what he's able to do.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. So this movie was apparently banned in some theaters. I've read in Phoenix, I'm not sure about my statistics. And it was mainly because of that one of the subsequent scenes, that whole skinny dipping scene where there are just a lot of naked people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was interesting. I could see why that would be controversial in any time, also considering that they're high schoolers. But I actually liked, again, the, like, back to the class or something, I liked the incredible juxtaposition of just that the room where that pool is in compared to every single room in that, or every single space in like the town they're from. There was not, it doesn't look like there was a speck of dust in that place, you know, and it seems like every other shot of the film in other places, there's just dust and decay. And I mean, I think like that, as like kind of interesting as that scene is, I think it was cool to show that kind of difference in their little corner of Texas, that there is like these still social and class differences, and they do guide things. And it, you know, it's also like paired with the scene with her mother telling her to like essentially marry a rich guy and stuff.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I hadn't thought about how clean and new it looks compared to everything else in this movie. You're so right. The other thing is that it's so wet. Like, this movie is parched.
Yeah.
There's always dust. There's always wind. Like, you never see, except for the reservoir that they go to with Sam, where is the moment where he does look back at with some sort of, you know, I don't know. So there's some nostalgia. There's some missed regret. There's all this sort of mix for him. There's water there, but they're talking about how there's no fish in it, right? Like they're unable to use it. And yet the water in this scene is in abundance, and it's clean, and it's full of like these like naked high school kids, these rich naked high school kids. Like this is, it is a you know, both in terms of I like what you're saying about how sort of clean and new it is, and also how just how they're able to have water. Like the rest of the town, this other town can't get water, it feels like, you know?
And also, yeah. I mean, to put it bluntly, but as opposed to the reservoir, it's like full of life, like literally full of life,
yeah,
and full of joy,
right,
and hope.
Vitality,
and optimism and whatever.
Yeah.
As opposed to just a dead sea of no fish.
No, it's true. And even like, again, not to get weird about it, but like even these kids' like bodies, they're so like perfect. Because when you see like the people in the town's bodies, usually there's a lot of times some kind of deformity or some kind of scar or even just the dustiness, you know? So it's
or just grimy.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like the town just wears you down over time, that these kids just haven't been in the town long enough to become haggard. Like they will be. They just aren't yet.
Well, maybe.
Well, but these kids are from a different town. The kids in the pool are in Wichita or Wichita Falls. They're in a different town.
Yeah.
That feels very that feels better off.
Okay.
Yeah.
But even still, like, I feel like maybe it's just, you know, even if they're not in town, like, just, like, life hasn't beaten them down. Maybe life won't beat them down. Maybe they'll be able to escape it because of their money or their situation or whatever. But it still feels like there's a dynamic between, like, even Sybil Shepherd, I mean, isn't beaten down because she's young, but, I mean, she's not making great decisions in this movie, so.
No, for sure. But I feel like those kids, again, like, they don't have to be, they seem so young because they don't have to be adults yet. I'm assuming a lot of them are going to college. Whereas, like, Sonny and Dwayne are, like, forced to be adults very, very fast.
Right. That's such a good point, yeah.
Yeah, and like, that's, like, the difference between them. And it's, yeah, I don't know. Just, that's, to me, like, a super cool scene.
Yeah.
You mentioned, what's it called? Dwayne goes away, and then JC starts dating Sonny. JC has an affair with, not an affair, just like a one night thing. That felt creepy, obviously. That was like one of the most jarring moments. I guess it's like a partner of her father's, but also her mother's like lover. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that kind of feels like another thing that sort of might stem out of boredom. You know what I mean? Just like, what else is there to do in a way?
I mean, maybe. Yeah. No. Certainly, there's. I mean, from her perspective, perhaps. And that was just, that was like one of the more uncomfortable moments, as opposed to like the age difference, I suppose, between Ruth and Sonny. Like that age difference one was like, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely played for creepy, and there's no humor in that, or very, very, very little. Like, it gets very serious, and it's one of the things that the tone of this movie you were asking about at the beginning is so kind of slippery in this way. Like, it shifts so quickly, and this is maybe as dark as it gets until there's actual death, you know, in the movie. But that's, no one is going to come out well from this experience. And this one does feel more predatory as it goes. Like, that's, and as I understand it, the first release of the movie, which had to be only 2 hours long, this scene was shorter. Didn't show as much. Mm. There are a few scenes that were, in the 90s, all versions made since then, sort of expanded a bit. There's some scenes that were added here and there, put a few more minutes back in the movie. And this is more graphic than what I believe. This is one of the scenes. It's more graphic than it was when the movie first came out.
Gotcha. Yeah. Huh. That's interesting. And then I don't want to say I like, but I find it interesting her, like, mother's reaction when she comes home, that she doesn't, like, even, like, she cares, and she essentially, you know, tells her she should date other people, obviously, but she's not, like, freaking out or flipping out or kicking her out somewhere, you know?
Well, I kind of got the sense that her mom had been there, right? Like, that she had been JC at one point.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a good point. Is it, who plays the mother? Sorry.
Ellen Burstyn.
Oh, Ellen Burstyn, of course. The legendary Ellen Burstyn. Yeah. Yeah, no.
The Exorcist. Yeah. Yeah.
And she's just so.
She's so good.
She's so good at that character. Like, where you're just like, oh my God. Like, you know? And is it there where she slips in the whole thing with Ruth and Sonny? It might be there, or it might be a different moment.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah.
And then that's when, I don't know, JC's like, oh, well, Sonny's always been into me. And then she kind of flips that around. She just has an interesting arc because, you know, eventually they get married.
Is it interesting or is it just real sad? Like, it doesn't feel like she's doing anything because she wants to. It just feels like she either, it's because she can.
I'm interested in it, but it is sad. Maybe I'm interested in it because it's sad.
No, it is. I think it is. It's kind of fascinating because she sometimes she zigs when you think she's going to zag, and then sometimes she just keeps zagging. You know, like she'll make a choice that is either, sometimes she'll make a choice that feels opposite to what she'd made before, but then other times she'll just keep making kind of the same mistake. She strikes me as someone, if it's not boredom, at least it's sort of acting out. You know, it's pushing against her limits to try and push. Again, must come up in these other high school movies that you know, characters who are trying to sort of test all the boundaries that they have. And it, for sure, you know, how much of her sleeping with this guy is to get back at her mother, how much of it is to have an experience, how much of it is to sort of wake up from whatever the sort of issues are in you know, the boredom that she's got, how much of it is just it's the only a sense of adventure. Like, I don't know, it feels like it's all a lot of those things, and those things sort of, she's self-justifying with those things at different times. But that's, I think, part of what makes it fascinating to me anyway, is that her motivations seem specific, but not like she's always even aware of them.
Yeah, no, and that's what I was gonna say. Like, it reminded me of, like, her motivation essentially to get married. You know, it didn't seem like 100% sincere. Mm-hmm. And it ends up being like, I mean, they might still legally be married, I don't know, but it ends up being like a marriage of a couple hours, essentially. You know, I think she, like, part of her likes that reaction she gets out of her father, you know, like, that. I think that's what she was looking for, because she leaves a note, right? And she's like, oh, I didn't want them to worry about me. But that's totally part of, whatever, if she knows it's her thinking or not, it's totally part of her plan there, I think.
Yeah, by that point, you're like, she wants attention, if nothing else, at that moment. And she's there's this, that great bit where they're driving back from having gotten married, and they're in the car, and he's like, okay, we're married now, and, you know, sort of like has all these ideas, and she sees the police car they pass, and then watches in the rearview mirror as it turns with some relish.
Yeah,
watches it turn around and like come hunt them down. And I just, she's playing, like, she is the manipulator there. She's been manipulated in this movie, and now she's learning how to use all of the emotional, sexual, all the tools that she has at her disposal to sort of, you know, to manipulate events around her. Sometimes it feels like like a cat playing with a mouse, like just because she can, and other times for sort of more, maybe more empathetic reasons. But the movie sort of puts us with her in that moment. Kind of you sense the thrill of this is not, she's already bored of, you know, of Sonny. Like she doesn't want to be married to this guy. Now she wants the next sort of episode to happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it also leads to an interesting conversation, or I guess car ride home between Sonny and her mother there, that just, I don't know, it just adds to the realism of the film, because she's not even that upset, you know? She kind of just like, she knew it was coming, and she tells him that like, oh, you should have just stayed with Ruth, you know?
Like, yeah. She says, you're lucky we saved you from my daughter.
Which is amazing. And,
yeah.
And again, I love her because she's such... the mother, because she's such a realist, you know, and she's like, there's no, maybe at one time she was like somewhat of an idealist, but she just, I guess she picked the most real option because she ended up, well, apparently, you know, the father wasn't always rich, but like he's the one who struck oil, but then she says like, she's the reason he struck oil, you know, she scared him into it. That was her line. You know, so it's again, I think the mother and the daughter are so similar, because at one point too, she, at least it seems like she had the same kind of power, as you're saying.
Yeah, totally. I hadn't thought about it this way, but what you're saying is so right. She's the realist at that moment. She can see everything. Like she understands how this all worked out in her life, how it's working out for Sonny and for JC, and like she's seeing all of it now, and kind of gives him this gift in this moment to say, look, this is what's going on. You need to choose, you know, to face up to what things that you've done, make the best of what you've got, and, you know, figure out what is in this world for you, and don't do things because other people are sort of like, you know, like moving you around the board, you know? And I think that that's a real, out of her sort of pain and being able to see then her and regret and her choices, and then being able to see what her daughter is doing sort of snaps her into the sort of way of thinking, oh, I see this all now. And that she gifts that to Sonny is, I think, a sort of real moment of compassion in the movie.
Yeah, no, for sure. Any other scenes you guys remembered or want to talk about, or notes or something?
Should we talk about the poor kid dying at the end of the movie?
Oh, that poor boy. That was Sam's son, right? Or what?
I don't think.
Or a guy he took care of, like a kid.
Yeah,
he took care of.
I think it was just somebody the neighborhood, not like pity case, but you know, obviously something wrong with him, and just I think the kids for the most part liked him, at least, you know.
I wasn't sure if he was like taken in by Sam or just.
I think he was looked after by Sam. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's his biological.
Oh, no. Yeah, no, I figured it was son. Like some kind of. Okay, so.
Yeah.
And he's an interesting character, because I feel like if you twist the actions of this movie a little bit, you could say that like he's been taking advantage of this whole time. But it feels like, and maybe it's just naivete, however you pronounce it, but it feels like the kids sort of do want, they do have his best interests at heart. And you can tell that like they actually do care about him, even if they sort of show it in weird ways, mm-hmm. like getting him a hooker. Like, it just sort of feels that they do care. Like, they're not trying to be mean to him. It might come off that way. It's just, he's sort of a lightning rod for trouble in a weird way, just because he's so
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's something to be said about that, because they did, like the prostitute, for example, they did say, like, it wasn't like, oh, wouldn't it be hilarious? It was more like, oh, he's never gonna get a girl unless we do this, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And still, like, in, you know, hindsight, that's probably not a nice thing to do, but, I mean, they're also, like, it's a dumb teenage decision, essentially. And then it just builds, after Sam dies, you see, like, Sonny really kind of take care of him, and then he dies like that, as you said. Oh, heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. Especially the fact that, like, no one seems to care that he was run over, except Sonny.
Yeah, they're not caring about him as a person. The crowd that gathers around him, he's still being viewed as a little bit of an oddity, or the event is sort of being made clinical in some way by some of these people. Like, it doesn't land for them the way it does for him.
No. And then I think Sonny has that line, like, he's sweeping, you son of a bitches, or something like that.
Yeah.
He was sweeping, right? Because he was in the street sweeping. No, and they're just all like, oh, yeah, you know, he probably just wandered on the street. You know how he is. Wandered in the street. That was a little heartbreaking saga there. But, you know, another dose of reality in this town that just... It seems like every single vice or crime... Maybe there's gambling in the pool thing. Oh, there's gambling. Yeah, of course, because they gamble on the game. Yeah,
right.
So...
right.
So every single vice happens in this town because there's that weird little vignette, I guess, where that older kid steals that little girl.
Yeah, the preacher's kid.
It's the preacher's kid. Yeah. That, I didn't expect that in the film. I'm glad he didn't go any further, but that's like something too. You're like, oh my God, you know?
Yeah. Look, there's a real villain in this movie. It's repression. So many of the things that go... The movie seems to be saying that so much of the pain and heartache in this thing have to do with especially sexual repression, but repression of all kinds, self-repression, and that it's sort of our... You know, the only people who have any hope are ones who are able to sort of, you know, break out of that in some way. We should note, too, that the actor who's playing the boy who gets killed is Sam Bottoms, is Sonny's brother in real life, his younger brother in real life.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, and that scene, I don't know, for me, you know, being as close as I am with my sibling, seeing... I see a lot of realism in that scene as he's, you know, kneeling over his in real life brother's body and sort of mourning him. Like it's
That makes sense. I didn't know that was his brother. Huh, that's cool. Yeah.
And that kid doesn't say a single word the entire movie.
Wow. That's powerful. We talked about the ending, the Cloris Leachman ending.
Yeah.
I guess we talked about it a little, but it is. So we didn't mention that Sonny and Dwayne get into that scuffle because obviously, you know, JC's with Sonny now and Dwayne's pissed off and then he essentially like blinds him for part of the movie, right? Because he's got that eye patch.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But then they kind of come to terms with it later in the film. And, you know, you mentioned he walks him off to his bus to Korea. And they enjoy the actual last picture show of the town. Does anyone know, or can we guess why? Oh, sorry, what were you gonna say?
Oh no, go ahead. No, go.
I was just gonna say like why it was called the last picture show, just because of cool line in the film, or it's from the book, obviously.
Yeah, well, it's the last the book hinges on the last movie in the play in this town, and the idea of the various metaphors for this town dying, for this community's sort of, you know, not really rotting away, but sort of like the buildings kind of abandoned and falling in on themselves. Like it's a old decaying, dying, dusting town that feels like it's going to blow away, you know? And I think it's sort of emblematic of that. Also both. Well, yeah. And yeah, there was nothing to do in this town before, there's really not going to be anything to do in this town once the movie theater is gone.
Yep. So depressing. Anyway, if there's nothing else to mention, why don't we rate this film? So on High School Slumber Party, we rate things from 1 through 5, but we have to come to a consensus on what we want our scale to be, 5 being the best, 1 being the worst, but... What do we want to rate this on?
Oh, boy. I even thought about this while we were watching the movie, and I don't have anything.
This has been the hardest thing to figure out on this show.
You're talking about picking an element of the movie?
Yeah, like, you know.
Yeah, so, I don't know. You started this discussion on tone, which seems to cover everything from the script, the story underneath the script, the way it's shot, the way it sounds. I mean, there's something very specific about the tone it's getting at. I don't know if that's specific enough for you. Or,
no, sorry. I much dumber, my question.
Okay.
Trust me. I wish I was that smart. But no, we just want to pick an object to rate it on, like literally like the scale of, you know, like American Pie was mutilated pies.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Much sillier than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the moment then when I should tell my American Pie story?
Yes, go ahead.
When I was in film school, we had to take scenes from movies and or take the script and take a scene and reshoot it. And we had to act in each other's movies. And one day my friend Rachel said to me, "Hey, would you be in my scene?" And I said, "Sure." And she said, "Okay, we're going to," this was in Manhattan. She said, "Okay, we're going to go up to Larchmont, upstate New York a little bit and in the suburbs and do a scene." I said, "Okay, great." And then my memory is it was on the train on the way up that she handed me the scene, and I was to play the Jason Biggs character in the pie fucking scene.
Oh my God.
In American Pie. And so somewhere in the world, there is VHS tape.
No.
Of 23-year-old me. Fucking a pie in my friend Rachel's exercise.
Oh my goodness. So, I mean, well, I have some questions because we did have some questions on American Pie about the physics of it. Well, what kind of pie was it? Was it like a pie, like an apple pie, like the film? Or
no, my memory is that she wanted something that would resonate on more color-wise. So I think it was cherry. I think it was red.
Interesting.
Yeah. And of course, she had to have a few because there had to be a pie. You know, we had to do it more than once. So, you know.
My God.
That's great to know. I'm glad we were able to.
That doesn't get us any closer to
no.
To this. You could do brooms for sweeping. You could do movie theaters. You could do mile markers, old highways, broken down cars.
How many pieces of clothing would you awkwardly take off this movie?
Five being the best then, right?
I guess. It doesn't really work as a rating scale.
I think it does.
Okay.
Okay, so Joey, you can go first.
Five awkward bras taken off. I mean, I'd say, you know, we rated The Edge of 17. I feel like The Edge of 17 is a movie that I'll watch more ultimately just because it's, you know, modern and not just more my aesthetic, but like this is just the best movie that I think you might, like we talked about on that episode, like that might be the best movie you ever cover, like this might not be the best movie you ever cover, like this is just, it's so good and so raw and so real and so gritty, and just I'm just glad that, you know, we all got to talk about it tonight.
Yeah, Edge of 17 is a great, and I gave it a 5, great high school film, but this is a great film. So, Tobin, how about you?
Yeah, I love The Edge of 17. Yeah, but I agree with what you're saying. So I'm going to say this is also worth 5 awkwardly removed items of clothing because you need to possess this movie. Like, you need to really own, like, this needs to be yours. You know, you need to see this movie and you need to absorb this movie. This is not a movie, as high school movies go, this is not one that you probably will put on at a real slumber party. You know, it's not one you're going to put on like as comfort viewing, but when you're ready to sit down and see a real movie that is truly entertaining and masterfully crafted, that happens to be about high school students and ends up being about so much more, this is the movie you go to.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And it's certainly not the film where you're taking the Ben and Jerry's and you're watching it with your friends. Yeah. But it's great. And I'm also going to give it a 5 awkward removal clothing apparatus things because it's another one that reaches my 5 scale, but I mean I can't knock this film. It's one of the best films I've ever seen, so and it's a high school film, so like that's awesome. Again, for all the reasons we stated here, if you guys haven't seen Edge of 17, well
well, that too, though. You really should see Edge 17 if you haven't, yeah.
If you guys haven't seen The Last Picture Show, I really suggest you see it. It's awesome. And if your friends haven't seen it, you'll look smart to your friends by recommending it. It's true. This is like like a filmmaker's film, you know.
My roommate in college, we both got into, like, we moved into the dorm. We didn't know each other yet. We both started putting up VHS movies across, and both had these big collections for 1997 VHS collections. And one of the movies he had and a poster he had on his wall was Last Picture Show, and I had never seen it. It was one of his favorite movies. And so I have to credit Joe Bolenbaugh for introducing me to this movie. And we bonded over this. He loves it to this day, and so do I.
That's a cool, like, that's a baller college move to have that poster.
Yeah, totally, totally.
You know, everyone brings their posters like, this is the movie I like, and I'm smart for it, you know? And it's like, oh, you like Big Lebowski? Cool. Like, you know,
I like a different Jeff Bridges film.
Yes. Essentially. Yes. Yeah. Oh, man, that's really cool. You remind me of something that I forgot to ask. What sleeping bag are you guys bringing to the slumber party? Joey, you've brought one before, but... Now you can imagine any sleeping bag you want to bring to the slumber party.
I'll let Tobin go first because I'm drawing a blank right now. Let me figure it out.
Okay, Tobin.
Oh, this is easy. This is easy. This for this movie, you go to the naked pool scene and you don't take any sleeping bag at all.
Wow, how edgy.
That is an edgy pick for an edgy film. Nice.
I did fuck a pie.
Or multiple times.
Multiple times, yes.
The back of that DVD cover or VHS cover says, like, you'll never look at pie the same way again. Did
I haven't.
I was going to ask, did the pie change you?
Yes. Some people ate not the pies I actually.
Oh, I was gonna say whoa.
But some of the pies that we didn't, I could not eat any pie that day. I'd had my fill.
Very fair.
Or I'd filled the pie. Yeah. I don't know.
One way or the other. Joey, have you come up with one?
Well, I'm definitely gonna bring a sleeping bag, and I'm gonna hide in shame after that story was rehashed again. I'm gonna bring a Red River inspired, maybe like a old timey like cowboys and Indians, maybe like a Lone Ranger sleeping bag. I think it's not exactly the aesthetic of this town, but I think it's close enough to make sense for this kind of movie.
No, for sure, that's a good one.
That's good.
Good sleeping bags, guys. Well, thanks. I really like that. So now's the fun time, Joey, your favorite time, where people get to plug what podcasts they're on and where to find them.
Oh, boy. Okay, so I'm on, I don't know how many, a bunch of shows. Just go to cageclub.me/Joey, see all the shows. The important thing of note, really, because I'm not doing enough already, is that Mike and I are going to announce shortly two new shows that we're doing that Tobin knows about, that I think you know about too, Brian.
Yeah,
and
that, if we're thinking the same thing.
And also look for Tobin's 25 coming soon to the Cage Club Podcast Network.
I can't wait for that. Again, that's the film education that I missed that I'm going to get via the Cage Club Podcast Network. I'm excited. So Tobin, contenders, what's your stuff? What are you up to?
Yes, as you're waiting for Tobin's 25, which will be interesting because we'll see how many of those I stand by. I heard a few that I would not put on that list today, but while you're waiting for that, you can check out my podcast, The Contenders, I do with my sister about movies directed by and starring fearless women.
Yeah, I do enjoy The Contenders. It's one of my favorite shows on this network.
Oh, thanks.
And can people follow you anywhere or...
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter at Tobin Addington, and you can follow The Contenders at contenders_pod.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys, so much for coming.
Oh, wait, hold on. One other thing. Unrelated to this. Sorry to cut. I mean, I know how, like, rude it is when people cut off, like, you know, your outro, whatever. But
because it's like a slumber party. You know, we were about to go to bed yawning.
Yes.
And the one kid kept us up with one more thing.
So, the most important thing, I don't know how I forgot this, but when I was talking about my high school film class before, the movie that I saw in that class that I liked, that I remember liking more than any other, that has particular importance to this network, was Raising Arizona. I was like, oh. And I was like, I don't understand what this, because I had never seen anything like that. And the guy's like, the teacher's like, this is what we call a black comedy. And I was like, oh, well, then this is exactly what I want to see, because this is wonderful. So, of course, go check out Cage Club. We have not done that for Revisited yet. We've been saving that for sort of down the road. But, you know, that's one of... Actually, don't listen to that episode of Cage Club, because that was a movie that, like, we didn't take notes on, really, because Mike and I were both like, oh, we love this movie, we're going to talk about it, we know exactly what to talk about, and it wound up being, like, half an hour. So don't listen to that. Just go watch Raising Arizona, because it is wonderful.
Oh, yeah, no, and that was something that surprised me when I first started listening to you guys. I'm like, oh, I expected a longer episode.
Oh, yeah, that's like my most embarrassing, or not embarrassing, I'm disappointed in our showing on that episode.
That's why you do the rewatch, though.
There we go.
Maybe that's not why.
That's going to be a good one.
Yeah, for sure. All right, guys. Well, thanks for coming on. Thanks for educating me on this wonderful, wonderful film, Last Picture Show. Time to go to bed, right?
I don't know if that was more American Pie acting or what, but that was perfectly timed.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Thanks, Brian.
Big Texas thank you to Tobin and Joey. That was awesome. What a great, great movie. I feel like educated now. I feel like we've raised the bar here on High School Slumber Party. Unfortunately, next week, while a lot of people enjoy this movie, and it is a fun movie, I don't know if the Oscar bar will be able to be kept at that level, because next week's film is Encino Man.
Recently, two high school students unearthed a prehistoric man in their own backyard. Their story is completely true. Encino Man.
Flamage. Oh, he is so greasy.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy it hurts.
Wow, who's the guy with the dork squad?
Is he fine or what?
This guy is our ticket to fame and popularity. All we gotta do is get him enrolled in school, and he'll help us become popular.
He's a looker.
Link, be careful!
He's dope. I'd go out with him.
Go, Zongas.
I'm too sexy for Milan. Too sexy for Milan, New York, and Japan.
Today, buddy, we're gonna discuss the beverage.
What are you doing, Mrs. Stroney?
We figure with a little juice.
No, wheezing the juice!
Go, wheezing the juice!
Hollywood Pictures presents Encino Man. He's a million years old.
Milk does the body good, huh?
Great hair.
And living proof that evolution is not an exact science.
Oh, man, what are we up?
Get out the fresh nugs. Wheezing the juice.
Ow!
Buddy, you got him talking like you now.
Song.
Hope you guys like Pauly Shore. That's all I'm gonna say. No, but it's a fun movie, and can't wait to chat about it and for you guys to listen next Friday. So as you know, Joey, Tobin, and a lot of the guests I bring on are proud members of the Cage Club Podcast Network. We got so many great shows on there, so many to name. We named a couple during this episode. We're always plugging away. Definitely just log on to cageclub.me, that's cageclub.me, to check out all the shows you can ever imagine on films, comic books even, music, pop culture. We got it, you know? If you're here and you enjoyed this, there's plenty of other shows you're going to enjoy on the Cage Club Podcast Network. So regarding this show, spread the word. Tell a friend. You can listen to this show anywhere you get your podcast, essentially. Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or on cageclub.me. Lots of places. So your friend can't be like, oh, I have an iPhone and you have a Droid, so we probably can't listen to the same podcast. No, you can listen to this show anywhere and everywhere. I actually was listening to it in the cab in Austin. Yes, I guess I am that arrogant. It was very late night, and I was just happy that the cab driver let us pick whatever we want, and I saw they had iTunes, so I played it. All right, I don't need to justify this. It makes me feel like Kanye West, and that's not a good thing. Anyway, remember to like this show on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, on Instagram, chat with me. I love, you know, discussing things on social media. I want to get the dialogue going. Class participation is a big part of your grade, so make sure you participate on social media. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. See you next Friday for Encino Man. Later, dudes.
Tannerine High School, we love you ever so grand. We will always be so loyal. Out of
we love you, and we'll fight for you.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.